So we're 2 weeks into our Vassa retreat. And I'm sure everyone is probably enjoying the spaciousness of the monastery and the quietude we have. Two weeks, it still feels like just the beginning, but it's probably enough time to have also experienced and observed all sorts of different convolutions of the mind, even in a simple setting with a simple kind of schedule. You know, the mind is still the mind. It's still fueled by karma, craving, and ignorance. And so it goes through its own convolutions and revolutions and cycles, if you like. But as I've said before, these are all... you know, if we look at these experiences from the point of view of, you know, this isn't what I want, or this isn't what enlightenment is, or this isn't what the path should be, or it's not what I should be experiencing. If we come at it from that angle, we're just bound to suffer. The same as in any meditation sitting, any time we sit down, if we come at it with a view that it should be one way, then inevitably our experience will be another way. And so it'll create friction or frustration in the mind from the expectation. And if we don't see that expectation or that view for what it is, then we'll continue to suffer because we're coming into conflict with just the reality of the way it is. And we're not quite seeing that actually there's the opportunity from learning just from the way it is. That in fact that's where the path to liberation actually lies, in just the way things are, in however you experience them. That is, if we can bring mindfulness and wisdom, or mindfulness and right view, to make the best of that opportunity. In truth, every moment, every waking moment is an opportunity for seeing clearly, for seeing into the nature of reality, looking at our experience directly, and learning from it, learning about it. The Buddha's teaching is really nothing other than telling us, directing us to this experience of this body-mind and all the convolutions of suffering the mind moves through. The Buddha has detailed and declared and in his teachings tries to help us get a handle on what's happening and how to look at this experience in a way that will bring fruit, that will bring great fruit. So, you know, there's one very short way of talking about the path is one could just say simply abandon the hindrances, establish the four foundations of mindfulness, and develop the awakening factors. That's it. That's all you have to do. Abandon the hindrances. Establish the four foundations of mindfulness and develop the awakening factors. Doesn't sound like too much when you say it like that. It sounds like you can kind of get a handle on it, right? But within these experiences lay our whole life. The experience of the hindrances, the experience of four satipatthanas, establishing the four foundations of mindfulness, and developing the awakening factors. Now, these are all related. These are all intricately related, actually. The four foundations, which is really has been called the heart of Buddhist meditation, is really the territory where we're working all the time. To establish mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, and mindfulness of Dhamma, or the phenomena that we experience in relation to Dhamma. This is the territory where we're meditating, where we're inquiring, both developing samatha or calming, concentration, and insight. And this is just the territory of our beingness. So I find it quite easy to get interested in it. You know, whatever you're doing, whatever you're experiencing, if you have a look at it, you can see it in terms of body, feeling, mind states and Dhamma. Any time. It's all there. But particularly establishing mindfulness of the body in a particular way, and mindfulness of feeling in a particular way, mindfulness of mind states and dhammas in a particular way, is what will help ripen wisdom and bring the heart into more and more clarity. Getting to know this body. You'd think we'd know it already. We've lived with it the whole of our lives. But we know it in a certain way. We know it in a very automatic way, in a quite a habituated way, and in a way that we're so identified with it. But if we start to look, what is the experience of this body? Not only is it changing all the time, but we discover, you know, we've got some quite strong relationships to it. If it feels pleasant or if it feels painful, it can evoke quite strong mind states, quite strong reactions from us. When I look at my own body, the experience of my own body, you know, when I'm feeling low or low energy or not so well, it can just feel like a heavy lump I'm dragging around, you know, and I don't feel good about it. I don't feel good towards it. But if I bring my mindfulness to that, I actually discover, you know, there's this unpleasant feeling. There's this feeling of heaviness or irritation, and a feeling of aversion towards the unpleasant feeling. And when I become aware of that, suddenly possibility opens up. Because I understand a degree of the Four Noble Truths, I don't shy away from suffering so much. I can send my mind, okay, let's go to this unpleasant feeling. This is the experience of dukkha, this resistance. Can I breathe with that? Can I hold that in my mind, in awareness? Can I have some patience with that? Can I have some kindness with that? This is an inquiry. And I'm interested in it because, you know, this is my suffering in this moment. I'm interested in understanding how to be free of it. Not through aversion can we be free of it. Not through suppressing or oppressing or ignoring, but only through fully waking up to it, only through fully understanding and seeing it clearly. So, okay, what is it? What is this thing, this feeling that's irritating? So being willing to bring one's mindfulness to bear just on that experience in the present, having woken up to the First Noble Truth. I'm interested. And then as soon as I bring my attention and mindfulness to that, something starts to shift and change all by itself. That's a mysterious thing in itself, because if I hadn't have brought my mindfulness to it, I would have continued in a kind of identification with it, continued being miserable about it and being averse towards it, and probably that would have, you know, inspired some more miserable thoughts and miserable memories and miserable projections for the future. Maybe worry about illness or what's going on with the body and poor me. So you get into this whole identity production flavored by the mind state of aversion or the feeling tone of unpleasantness. And that can all be very familiar and can go on unchallenged. But the more I sensitize, the more we come to practice this path and sensitize to the body and trust that this present moment is always bringing an opportunity. There is always this opportunity for establishing mindfulness on what's present, whether it's pleasant or painful. Sometimes you might be wrapped up in a pleasant feeling. There might be some piti and sukha emerging in the meditation. Still, you bring your mindfulness to bear on that, to understand what are these mind states. Not to disturb the deepening of the meditation, but just out of interest and inquiry. Because these feelings, as pleasant as they are, as delightful as they are, and as skillful as they are, they're talked about as skillful states which help deepen samadhi, they're still not who and what we are. So we're observing them, we're understanding them, how they come into being. Being skillful states, we learn how to support them, maintain them in being, not through a very strong doing, but through a skillful mode of attention and mindfulness. You know, and then we lose it. Suddenly our mind has gone back to an unpleasant feeling. And mindfulness knows that too. Ah, that's how piti or sukha comes to cessation. Attention averts, we take interest in something else, something grosser perhaps. Or the I thought comes in and begins to own it and project something into the future. So becoming sensitive to the movements within this body-mind, the movements of form, of sensation, of materiality, as I was instructing in the guidance in the meditation, I'm just tuning into the present sensations, whatever they may be, being willing to tune in, being interested enough to tune in and just stay present with that. Develop that which can know the changing quality of sensation and the shifts, how it shifts around different parts of the body. To notice when in the mind that sense of ownership comes in, the sense of me and my body, or what I like and what I don't like, if it's pleasant or painful. All of this is the territory of the four foundations of mindfulness. And so you can see you're actually not just working on one in complete separation from the others. It's like as your attention sits with the body and the mind, different things will come, different things will appear. And there's a choice one makes, really, on what to focus on. What's most skillful to focus on at this point? Where's the interest? Is there dukkha present? Is one of the awakening factors emerging? How can we support that in being? So very, very subtle, skillful shifts we learn of attention. And this happens over time. So the learning ground is just our very experience. We learn from what's arising from moment to moment. We learn from the results of our interaction, if you like, the results of bringing mindfulness bringing attention, applying subtle effort in different ways to support or to let go of whatever states may be present. To learn how to relate to feeling tones of pleasant feeling tone or unpleasant feeling tone. In a way, it's not just learning how to relate, it's actually observing what happens internally when a pleasant feeling arises. What does the mind habitually do with that? Or when an unpleasant feeling arises? You're present to observe the habitual reactivity. And one can continue observing, or one may choose to skillfully intervene in one way or another and continue to observe as a result of that intervention, or to see the result of that intervention. So really this is just developing the toolkit, the skills, the skillful states of mind, the skillful way of applying intention, attention, mindfulness, metta, patience, interest, chanda, where we begin to, when we have something in view like a painful feeling, we can become quite interested in the resistance that develops, the habitual resistance to painful feeling. So we might start inquiring around that. Or we might start inquiring into, say, the feeling of if anger arises or aversion arises. We might start inquiring into that. This is cultivating the enlightenment factor of investigation of states. To know when aversion or anger is present. We also know, or we're instructed to know, when aversion or anger is not present. What's the mind like? What's this experience like? There's no aversion present. To get to know that as much as getting to know the mind when there is aversion present. And these have equal value. What we need to be careful of is that part of ourselves, the judge or the critic that can come in and say, oh, this isn't good, aversion's not good, anger's not good, desire's not good. And then our effort comes from a very different place. Our effort comes more from a sense of self with a preference and an agenda. Whereas mindfulness, if that pure mindfulness can see when something's present, if it's creating dukkha, and begin to inquire around it, there's a natural wisdom that develops that looks for how to release the clinging. We know that dukkha, the cause of dukkha, is craving and clinging. The abandoning of that craving and clinging, dukkha subsides. So just inquiring in this way, if suffering is present, where's the clinging? What's clinging? What's identifying with this? What's keeping it in being? I don't know about you, but I find these kind of inquiries, this kind of practice, to be really interesting, and I really enjoy having the space and time to engage in a prolonged inquiry with something, to watch how the mind and body changes over a prolonged period. And sometimes if things get very quiet, sometimes a little bit of a momentary bubble of boredom might arise, thinking, what's going on? Nothing much is going on. But as soon as I turn my mindfulness back to this experience of being, I mean, what could be more interesting than inquiring into this experience of being? At some level, it's such a mystery. And the Buddha's teaching is giving us pointers and indicators as to how to navigate this territory in order to bring about full awakening. So it's only a matter of remembering sometimes, remembering to turn to face your experience fully, directly, no matter how boring or painful or exciting. Just bring your full attention and like grab the horns of this bull called life, if you like. Just be willing to meet it head on, no matter what the experience, because herein lies your full awakening. Nowhere else. So the more you do that and the more you develop the skill of inquiry and learning how to balance the factors of samatha, you know, learning how to bring enough stillness to the mind to inquire. It doesn't have to be a full-on samadhi, but as you investigate, as your interest comes in, so your energy will come in. And these are developing the enlightenment factors, which will bring you to a place of one-pointedness, which will bring about samadhi, even as you're inquiring into your experience. So you don't get locked onto the idea that I have to develop this jhana, that I have to just stick with one meditation object and slog away at it and slog away at it and slog away. That's, you know, that could be enough to, you know, bore the pants off us, because we're not really turning to face what's my actual experience here. You know, maybe I'm frustrated, I'm completely frustrated. Well, what's that like? What is this feeling that I call frustration? Where is it? What does it feel like? Do I sense it in the body? Get interested in it. Similarly, the other feelings that we hate, confusion, don't we hate confusion? Grab it, grab a hold of it. Well, what is it? What does it feel like? What is this mind state of confusion? It's possible to know it, to see it, to understand what it's made up of. What does it feel like? Can I breathe with it? Can I bring metta to this moment of experiencing confusion or doubt or aversion or sadness? Whatever it is, as I've said before, whatever it is, it's all Dhamma. If we can see it as that, just everything you experience is Dhamma, is there to reveal something. So looking at it with right view is recognizing that opportunity, waking up to it, getting interested, inquire into it. It doesn't matter what it is, it's a mind state. So it's worth inquiring into, it's worth understanding. We don't have to understand it in terms of a history and a story. We want to understand its manifestation in the present. How does it affect this mind? How does it affect the body? As soon as you bring your mindfulness and investigation in, you'll find the interest and the energy starts working. You'll find these are new mental states that you're bringing in. They actually have an effect on what you're experiencing, and you'll begin to see that effect. And this is also the establishing of mindfulness in terms of mind states and of Dhamma. All four, really. You're checking out what's going on in the body, you're checking out what's going on with the feeling tones. We know if it's painful or pleasant or neutral. It's easy to get a handle on that. So it's a bit like cooking, you know. Say you've got a big pot of something on the stove, it's got all these different ingredients in it, and they take different times to cook, so you've got to add this at this stage and watch what point they get to a certain softness, and then you can add something else. So, you know, you've got your mind over a lot of things, the kind of heat, the different quality of the vegetables, the time, how you're doing in the kitchen, what else you need to chop. So your mind is around all of these things. This is just like the four foundations of mindfulness. Once you come to understand what they are in terms of body, feeling, mind states and dhammas, you're working it all together. And just as someone in the kitchen can become quite skilled with a familiar recipe, you know, so easily they can reproduce it. So it is with the mind, and as we develop meditation and gain more skill in seeing and interacting and developing and abandoning the hindrances, developing the enlightenment factors, looking at the ingredients, working with them, so it becomes easier, so you become skilled. So just as Nathan's being a bit of an apprentice in the kitchen at the moment, we can think of our, you know, our meditation retreat as an apprentice camp for meditation. You know, that we're, you know, we've got the time to, you know, can feel a bit clunky at times. We can forget things. Oh God, I forgot the onions. Can I make this recipe without the onions? And maybe you have to act quickly. You know, we forget what was mindfulness of Dhamma about? And go back to the books, the hindrances, right. The seven factors of awakening, right. The khandhas, right. Okay, go back to your meditation and start picking them out. Start seeing, what are they? What is it? What was that again? And recollecting, that's part of mindfulness, is to recollect the Dhamma. Recollect what you've learnt, recollect what you've heard, recollect what you've been taught, what you've read in the moment when you're sitting. What did the Buddha say about dukkha? About clinging? What was that? You know, about craving? That's part of mindfulness. Then we're already establishing the mindfulness awakening factor, establishing the investigation of Dhamma awakening factor, upon which comes energy. As soon as those three gather a certain momentum, then you get the pitti coming in, the pasadi, the tranquility, joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. These will start coming in. Admittedly, working those first three is the main stuff. It's like your training ground. But every now and again, these other four kind of waft in very nicely. But you can recognize them. Ah, they're the awakening factors. Isn't that wonderful? How they just appeared like that. Shame they've just gone again. Okay, so they appear and they disappear. This is also territory of insight. These are also factors that are conditioned, arise based on certain conditions. This is important insight to understand. So similarly, get as excited about the hindrances as you do the awakening factors. Maybe. Yeah? Maybe take a different view of the hindrances. Because honestly, as soon as you get to know the hindrances, the awakening factors are following right behind. So take them as an opportunity, you know, rather than restlessness or this torpor or that aggravation and aversion or what can I do with this sensual desire? Donuts, not that I eat donuts, don't bring donuts, whatever it is, you know, craving for something. Instead of, oh God, give it up, just, well, what is it? What does it feel like? What is the experience of craving this body in this moment? What's the mental object? How does that feel? It's an interesting simile from one of the enlightened bhikkhunis in one of her poems, that when Mara was trying to seduce her into engaging in sensual pleasures, and she said, sensual pleasures are no longer pleasures for me. They're like knives and javelins on a chopping block. Such a graphic image. That in contrast to full awakening, sensual pleasures are like knives and javelins against a chopping block of the aggregates. That's what it was. The chopping block of the aggregates. So this, you know, what we perceive as sensual pleasures, you know, a nice little bit of joy and sukha, for an awakened being, that's pretty gross. So we're not going to judge ourselves by that, but know that there's this tremendous difference of the pleasure of fully free awakened mind, that the pleasure of the senses are so coarse by that stage. So this is interesting to contemplate. You know, so next time sensual desire you know, ravages your mind, start contemplating it. You know, is there dukkha in here? What is it? You know, what's going on? Really contemplate every aspect of it rather than just think, oh, I'm hopeless. Oh, because that just, you know, reinforces self-view with a negative viewpoint and a kind of aversion, a self-aversion, and then depression, carry on. So every opportunity, everything we experience is a possibility for cultivating mindfulness, wisdom, the awakening factors. Right there, the opportunity for full awakening. So for me, in my practice, this may not be the same for anyone else, but if I find some aspect of my experience that I'm truly, authentically interested in, then I build on that. I really look at that, because these other awakening factors will follow on that. And mindfulness gets established far more easily when you're truly, authentically interested in something, not when you're just trying to do it because, you know, Dad told you to do it, do your scales, you know, whatever. There's a certain amount you learn by that, but it's not very enlivening. But, you know, say that you're really interested in something. Find out what it is for you and let yourself explore that and see what happens. And it can change from day to day or week to week, month to month, year to year. So it's worth mentioning too, perhaps, that before I finish tonight, the Buddha did say that the greatest spiritual austerity, I think it is the greatest, is Kanti Parami, or the greatest spiritual practice. Did he say greatest? Was the highest virtue is actually Kanti Parami, which means patience. It gets translated as patient endurance, which I never really liked, because to me it implied kind of a grit your teeth and bear it. So I turned it around for myself and called it enduring patience, which had a much softer. I thought, I can be enduring patience. I can't be patient endurance, but I can be enduring patience at least. You know, and he said, this is the highest virtue for burning up defilements, for burning up past karma. And sometimes that's what we have to remind ourselves about, because we encounter so much in this path of practice. At times it feels like you're just in a meteor storm. And maybe it feels like you've lost all your skill in meditation, you're just being bombarded or whatever. If you can recollect Kanti Parami, enduring patience, know that this too will pass. We can see on a more of a moment by moment level that things are changing, but maybe the overall sense of bombardment can feel overwhelming. But just recollect Kanti Parami. You know, sometimes we have to call on that and bear with it. In fact, his instruction, the Buddha's instruction to Angulimala, who was being stoned by the villagers when he went on alms round, he'd already attained Sotapanna. Angulimala was the murderer, the mass murderer, who ordained with the Buddha because he'd had the insight into Sotapanna. But still he had to bear with the karma, the resultant karma. And the Buddha acknowledged that and said, bear with it, you're suffering the karma of what you would otherwise have spent eons in hell for. But now he's attained Sotapanna, but he's still got to put up with this kind of difficulty. So patient endurance, we've all got, you know, karmic baggage. And don't believe it's going to stay around forever, but sometimes you just need to call on that ability to endure patiently. Enduring patience. To bring forth that quality of faith, of confidence, of trust, that this path that you're committed to is taking you more deeply, is taking you to awakening. It doesn't mean you stop inquiring within that bombardment, you know, because that inquiry and mindfulness can release you as well. But sometimes just evoking that sense of patience, kindness, and care for oneself as one endures is very important. So I'll just finish here tonight and offer these few words for your reflection.